remember before, I remember last year, the last decade of the 16th century, where so many plays written and acted in which Robin Hood appeared as a character. They were published in 1599, Robert Greene's play, George Greene, the King of Wakefield, was probably acted in 1588 or 89. George Peel W. the First, published in 1593, was acted in 1691. The anonymous and no longer extant play called The Pleasant Pastoral Comedy of Robin Hood and Little John was entered in the station register in 1599. The anonymous Look About You was published in 1600 but acted probably in 1599. And the two plays of The Downfall of Robert Earl of Huntingdon and The Death of Robert Earl of Huntingdon, the first written by Mundy and revised by Cutter, the second written by Mundy and Cutter together, were published in 1601 but acted in 1598. William Houghton's non-extant play, Robin Hood Pennyworth, was acted in 1601, and after more than a 30-year act, Ben Jonson wrote and left unfinished the Sad Shepherd, and it is the superb finish with dramatic fashion that Robert Greene apparently started in the World War Matter. We do not know the date of the composition of Jonson's fragment. The best guess is that he wrote it just a few weeks before he died in 1637. These plays have never been examined as a group, held together by the common use of the legendary of Robin Hood, but separately all have received scholarly attention. Schelling, for example, says in his Elizabethan playwright that the Mundy and Cutter plays smack of pseudo-historical but more of popular legend and folklore. In his book on the English History Play, Ridley describes the primary interest of the Mundy Cutter plays as being the romantic Robin Hood legend. And speaking of Peel's Edward I, Ridley says that the Robin Hood scenes are devoted to the body horse play of the Robin Hood ballad in a play that is otherwise historical. Schelling and Widmer are able to see the historical or pseudo-historical character of the Mundy and Cutter plays, as they could clearly see it in Look About You. But what they appear not to see is that in the Mundy and Cutter plays, as well as in George Peel's play, the writers are following the convention in which a nobleman sheds his title to become plain Robin Hood and retreat from the historical to a pastoral world. In Greene's play and in Jonson's play, the pastoralism is self-evident, and it is free of historicism. The conventions I see employed in these plays, either single or in combination, are two, and they are the conventions of a historical and the pastoral Robin Hood. This choice of dramatic representations of Robin Hood had behind it a mimetic tradition reaching back as far back as the 15th century. Then we know that Sir John Paston confirmed that he had lost a servant who played Robin Hood in St. George. Three of these short plays are survived, all three dramatizations of valid narrative, but they have no thematic connection with the Robin Hood plays written for the theater. Slight exception to this is the similarity of Robin Hood's encounter with a potter in the first play and his encounter with a tenor in Greene's play. Judged by the short plays surviving, all that can be said is that they belong to one of the mimetic traditions that prepared the way for the work of the literary dramatist. The dramatist had other Robin Hood traditions to exploit. In the first place, there was a large narrative tradition, the abundance of ballads and broadsides, innumerable tales, proverbs, and other songs of Robin Hood. In the narrative tradition, there was also the accounts and historical chronicles of such historians as Major, Grafton, Hall, and Stowe. And in the second place, there were narrative traditions outside of the first place. These included the custom of impersonating Robin Hood in the merit stamps and in the May game. In a great variety of ways, Robin Hood was so completely embedded in the fabric of national life in England that Drayton could say with no exaggeration that there was not a person in the island who had not heard of Robin Hood. The problem of the dramatist was not winning audiences to Robin Hood. That was easy because they were giving back to audiences that belonged to them in the first place. Rather, their problem was to represent the illusory world of legend in ways credible to the theatrical audience, and they solved the problem within the historical and cultural conventions of popular and learned traditions. The appeal of the historical convention is that it holds the audience to the illusion that it is seeing someone true because it is seeing a person who may have lived. The representation is currently based on a reality and it is therefore more limited than the creations of a vagrant imagination. But the dramatist had the imagination to escape the limits of mere historicism, to pass the convention, satisfy the audiences, because it put Robin Hood into a beautiful and festive world, a golden world superior to the real or historical world. And released from the restraints of the ordinary world, Robin Hood became a festive or morally edifying character, or both. The Catholic convention is imaginary, but stories are historical. Chronicles were the chief custodians of the traditions, tell stories of Robin Hood having no more fact behind them than any of the other formulations of the Robin Hood legend. Major, for example, writes in the fourth book of the History of Britain that Robin Hood is a subject of Richard the First and an outlaw and a thief. Repeating this much from Major, Great Gaston in 1568 adds that Robin Hood was descended from no accounted, or rather being of base stock and lineage, as for manhood and chivalry advanced his noble dignity of an heir. But being prodigal, he fell into debt, gathered the company of roisters and cutters, and offended the king who offered a reward for his capture. Instead, he was treacherously bled to death, and a storm marked his tomb at the still earth of Gaston, to the great comfort of travelers. I do not think Gaston invented the part of the history making Robin Hood an heir, nor do I think that Mundy or Chatter or the writer of Look About You invented the specific title of the Earl of Huntingdon by which their Robin Hoods are known. Invention of rank may be a pet or a rationalization, because it would be a paradox in a hierarchical society that a figure of such power as Robin Hood could not have a social position to match it. The problem can be resolved by ignoring the popular tradition that he was a yeoman and making him an heir. And this is what the writer of Look About You does. Or it could be resolved, as Mundy and Tuttle resolve it, by joining the popular tradition of Robin Hood as outlaw to the tradition of Robin Hood as heir by giving him first the title and then having him lose it. In the historical representation of Robin Hood, especially in the 16th century, he practically would have to have high rank. For having Robin Hood hobnob on intimate terms with royalty would be an implausible incongruity unless you had the birthright to be among them. The conventions of historical representation were extremely flexible, but it would have been difficult to accept seriously an upstart or unknown of mean birth to be on equal terms with royalty. In the Pasteur Convention, where the hero is released from such restraint, he is free, like the fools of Elizabethan drama, to be intimate and even to flaunt royal and noble persons. Historical convention did not check the inventiveness of the dramatist who used it. In Look About You, where the representation is exclusively historical, the writer retains only the traditional names of Robin Hood and Earl of Huntingdon. Everything else is his invention. What is historical in the play is that Robin Hood lives among the Plantagenets, that is, Henry II, Queen Eleanor, Prince Richard, and Prince John, whose names are the lingua franca of so much English legendary. Besides this, almost everything Robin Hood does in the play is a part of the action set into motion by the royal family. These conditions are also applied to the Mundy and Tuttle plays, but when Robin Hood retires into the forest in their plays, he becomes lord of the outlaw realm, and his actions become the measure of the conduct of erring lords, spiritual and temporal. In Peter's Edward I, Llewellyn, the Prince of Wales, plays Robin Hood as a pastime. But that pastime is also a variation of the Pasteur convention. Taken as a group, the Robin Hood plays rely less on historicism than they do on pastoralism. The writers, it would seem, preferred the imaginative possibilities of the Pasteur convention. Unlike the convention in the historical Robin Hood, that of the Pasteur Robin Hood is no longer allowed to it. Completely native in origin and character, the pastoral traditions of Robin Hood provided a native substitute for the characters found in pastoral drama imported from the continent. England had a woodland Arcadia in Kirwood Forest, and it had a forest hero to match any of the pastoral characters from the Latin world. With Little John, Nut, Scarlet, Starlock, and the Flowers, Robin Hood was a lively rustic, a high-spirited countryman, lording it over his country domain. In a poem such as the Jest of Robin Hood, the pastor here, who is a metaphorical protector of the sheep, sympathizes with and helps people whose lives are made miserable by hard lord, as Sidney says in Defense of Poetry, in the poem, in a celebration of the yeoman hero and his kind, also in Sidney's word, says that blessedness is derived to them that lie lowest from the goodness of them that sit highest. And so at first, this blessedness may be viewed as an ideal life to be contrasted with the realities of the world outside. In this respect, Robin Hood's forest appears to be one of those ideal worlds to which we men long to retire. In the annual impersonation of Robin Hood in the May Games, some of this golden world came to life. People went out into the forest and fields where an actor playing Robin Hood set the festive tone of a holiday. A completely festive character, this Robin Hood does not have the implications of social criticism implied in several of the ballads. Instead, the criticism was aimed at him, as a reveling idol who allows men and women to the immoralities of the Saturnalia. But sympathetically viewed, the impersonated Robin Hood joined with other revelers in a seasonal release from a wintry world indoors to a summer world outdoors. In the spirit of a holiday, class barriers were lowered, people were friendly and hospitable. It is this festive Robin Hood that Shakespeare has in mind, and as you like it, when Charles says of the old Duke, that he has gone to the forest of Arden, where, like the Robin Hood of old England, he sleeps the town carelessly as they did in the Golden World. If the convention of the past of Robin Hood in the Golden World had not been a part of the common language in question, Shakespeare could not have expected his allusion to be understood. And Shakespeare's use of the past of the convention, having sophisticated men play rustic, is like the use of it in the Robin Hood plays. The rustic or pastor Robin Hood is free from the restraints of convention, and he can use his freedom to pass the time carelessly, as he often uses it, or to criticize and correct the evils of the world. A nobleman masquerading as Robin Hood is a device Peel uses in Edward the First, when Llewellyn the Prince of Wales becomes a Robin Hood in the Welsh Mountains. Mumby and Settle also use a device by turning the Earl of Huntington into the Robin Hood of Sherwood Forest, but they were using a title and name already linked in popular tradition. A second device is to have no conversion, but to begin with a pastoral or rustic Robin Hood. Robin Hood's small role in Georgia Green the Tenor of Wakefield is that of a rustic of no sophistication, a Roman type right out of popular ballads and nothing more. The Robin Hood in Johnson's Sad Shepherd is a rustic of another kind. He is the lord of the Vale of Belvoir, the patronal lord of an annual festival in which he plays host to shepherds and shepherdesses of the valley. And this, by the way, is the only one of the Robin Hood plays where the native pastoral is joined to the continental pastoral. Whether he is a lord or a Roman, a converted or an original Robin Hood, what characterizes these several versions of the pastoral here is his innocence, and his innocence permeates the pastoral world in which he lives. I do not mean to imply that everything that happens to him is innocent, but that he sees everything in an innocent way. Terrible things happen to him in the Mumby and Settle plays, and he has a mild state of trouble in the Sad Shepherd. But trouble never perturbs his conviction that evil is uninfectious. The Robin Hood of Johnson's play is self-consciously innocent, particularly when he berates his critics for seeing evil in his festivities. Ordinarily, however, he dramatizes rather than talks about his innocence. It is evident in his relations with people, and most evident in his relationship with Marion. Whether she is his virgin bride, as she is in the Mumby and Settle plays, or his mistress, as she is in the other plays, neither the dramatist nor the Robin Hood are ironic about the relationship. There is no denial of its physical aspect, but it is untainted by the knowledge that it can be evil. The innocence is also evident in the relaxation of social barriers between people of different classes. All the Robin Hoods live on intimate and candid terms with their social superiors and inferiors. When Llewellyn becomes Robin Hood and Edward I, he and his followers adopt the legends remains, and they all become equals in a democratic society. When the Earl of Huntington becomes Robin Hood in the Mumby and Settle plays, he drops with his title the social pretensions and distinctions of the outside world, and he is on familiar terms with people of all classes. In Green's play, Robin Hood is a familiar of the King of England, and Johnson's Robin Hood, in a holiday spirit, climbs together with shepherds and shepherdesses who are his social inferiors. In the pastoral world, Robin Hood can mingle easily with all classes, and his relations with them are uninhibited by the restraint, by the fear of consequences that would prevail in the real world. Often this license is turned into direct or oblique forms of social criticism. In the Mumby and Settle play, Robin Hood becomes a Christ-like figure, suffering all things and all men. His moral perfection, obviously unattainable in the real world, is held up as a measure of the real world's infinite corruption. In the side chapter, in the first scene of the first act, Robin Hood and his friends turn critic to the real world and be called inferior to the imaginary and innocent world they inhabit. But there is also the impulsive reaction to the abuse of authority that Robin Hood hastens to correct in the Mumbly and Tubble plays when he rescues the widow's son from the gallows. Once more, he escapes the consequences ensuing from an attack on established authority. In the pastoral world, he twists the king's nose and gets away with it. Relaxation of social barriers in the pastoral Robin Hood plays resulted in part from the festival atmosphere. The pastoral world here is a world on holiday. In the Mumbly and Tubble plays, the holiday atmosphere is subdued by the moral earnestness of Robin Hood's Christ-like courage. But in the other plays, the holiday is unrestrained by a sense of responsibility. In Green's play, Robin Hood joins George of Green in eating meat and cakes before the tally of the King of England. In Peel's Edward I, Llewellyn as Robin Hood jokes and sings, unperturbed for a time by the hostility of Edward Longshanks, who kills Llewellyn and ends the pastoral interlude. Jonathan makes preparation for the festival of Otto's fragment, and had he finished the play, it undoubtedly would have concluded with a great festival unruffled by any kind of care. All the playwrights were too experienced, of course, in the real world to be able to create a complete innocent world where men could treat the town carelessly, as Shakespeare said they did in the Golden World. The pastoral convention, like the historical convention, was useful to the dramatist because it was an orderly formulation of a point of view toward the unwieldy totality of the Robin Hood legend. Through these two formulations, the legendary figure was made comprehensible, and in relation to the totality of the legend, the historical and pastoral conventions reduced Robin Hood to manageable proportions. Of course, the plays could not be, and were not, mere assimilations of legendary matter. The dramatists, though they used much of this matter, and though they relied on public knowledge of Robin Hood to make the representations as an understood, still had to be invented. And there was plenty of room for invention within the historical and pastoral convention, because within the conventions, the dramatists created their conclusions, their peculiar crossings of tradition and novelty, and their peculiar versions of a many-faced story with their special roles and characters. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Simeon. Now it's so that we should have some time here for discussion of the papers, but it would probably be desirable to wait until they have all been presented, and then any of you who have any questions about any of them can ask the gentleman who has read the papers. Second paper is by Professor John Office of the University of Michigan, An Aspect of Milton's Language.
It was a considerable part of Professor Tilley's paper to show that Milton's character revealed a progression of thought towards another more definite discipline. Milton's mind, he said, presses forward to some end. He will have none of what does not subserve his purposes. Power, order, stability, must come first, and sensibility, deception, sacrifice is made for. Thus we saw how Milton deliberately narrowed, as he grew older, the comparatively void sensibility shown in the nativity order. The point is, I think, that as Milton passes from Kermit and Elizabeth, after the long introduction of the greatest work, his mind, taking in so much more of the complexities of the world as it saw itself, was by that fact committed more and more deeply to serve the truth. The truth, the ordinary, the self, the trusted. The language of his expression will be formed according to the respect he owed to logic and reason, to truth and justice, and there would be little enough of what he owed to his special sensibility. Somehow he created the language he needed. The language to show the balance he had achieved in his imagination between the claims of the general and the particular, between the philosophical and the concrete, a way of transforming our almost Ovidian richness into the Gallic delicacy. But all distinction of materials is the right one, as characteristic of the later and of the earlier something. Newton, as his own witness in the sermon, that the love of truth determines his course of work. To me, readers, although I cannot say that I am utterly unfirmed in those words which both generations have given, the unaffirmative of those examples which the fine authors of eloquence have written in any learned tongue, yet too eloquent I find to be men to pursue some hearty love of truth. And that whose mind, however, is fully possessed with a fervent desire to know good things, and with a brief charity to improve the knowledge of them into others, can put them under speech. His work, as well as I can express, by so many nimble and early services put about him at command, and in very ordered style, as he would wish, fell aptly into their own places. He was less explicit in the passage on eloquence in Paradise Regained, but there he spoke of swelling, epithet, thick, loader, vanish, and a harlot, kiss. In the abstract, such statements mean all or nothing. Where they become useful when we relate them is that Merton takes to be the truth. What grand scheme his observations lead him to assume. And about this, one ought to be able to say something. Because we are to a degree the features of his language that are determined by a way of looking at the world that must have remained constant, and by a view of the order of the universe his knowledge before it. The study of what he meant by nature, for example, and how he uses words to describe nature will help us understand, in part, what he means by truth and how words may express that. The significant passages in Merton's story which reveal his attitude towards nature are consistent in assuming that nature is in essence a principle of being, and, more especially, of coming into being. Nature means either the essence of a thing, he writes, or that general law which is the origin of everything, and under which everything is. When Milton directed his attention to the process rather than to the principle of growth, he tended to regard the informing law of nature as a physical or even plastic power. There is a hint of it in a remark which refers to the theory of the will of the element. Still, if we look at the nature of elemental and mixed things, we know they cannot suffer any change of one kind or quality into another without the struggle of temporality. Such, from one point of view, is regarded as law in nature, from another is the principle that informs creation, and even the creation of soul. He says that it seems that the human soul is not created daily by the immediate act of God, but propagated from father to son in a natural order. Nor is there any reason to suppose that the influence as the divine blessing is less efficacious in imparting to man the power of producing after his form than to the other types of animated nature. At one place, at least, in Paradise Lost, the idea of law and the idea of generation are identical. And the temporalities are said to derive from the very life in the pregnant element. This wild abyss, the room of nature and perhaps her growth, that neither sea nor shore nor air nor fire, but all these in their present causes, look confusedly, and which thus must ever fight, unless the Almighty Maker then ordain his great materials to create more room. Such a notion is not far from the personification of nature, in the older manner of the Renaissance. But in making it generally less precedent, less concerned, but in such a way as people pass, for example. The ancient bird, its throat, opening her sort of room, seemed that it birthed in numerous living creatures, perfect forms, limbs, and full grown.
These various expressions of the nature of things and of the force that informs and controls them all come to its personification. This is as one might expect from the few invocations at the beginning of the third book of Paradise Lost. That is, in the first instance, a place of inspiration by the divine light is also a definition of what Milton understands to be the nature of the life of the universe. A statement so carefully expressed, it supports the materialist and physics of the term, at the same time, it affirms the idea of the materiality of things. As Mr. Langdon wrote, at the opening, the conception, this conception receives consummate expression. Your form no longer is the purpose of space, or the soul that inhabits within that particular body, but the spirit that, having a preference from God, produces his created universe. Availing himself of the associations of biblical usage and probably inspired by the new statement, Milton now calls this essential spirit light and identifies light, form, and essence. The imagination of Milton then light is the manifestation of the heavenly spirit, the first of things, the temptation pure, the bright influence, the bright essence in pure. Since light emanates from divinity, it carries with it wisdom and healing. And the progress of all forms towards perfection is made evident by their capacity to receive light. In these lines, with their vivid directness and beauty, we have the classic expression of Milton's belief in the interrelation of essential and visible conditions. With the green law summed up the nature of this conception of the universe in a way that helps relate all this to Milton's choice of words. The constant use of the old physics, the realm of chaos and earth, the world of the elements, the description of how the universe of death, their nature, traverse, breeds monstrous things, to the kind of the abyss, the ruin of nature, and perhaps her glory, are a few of the many examples that might be told. The interest is physical, not biological. It is, I think, necessary to qualify this, to say that a biological interest easily follows an awareness of the physical nature of things. And no less than the physical, it offers a systematic way of translating the impressions of the senses into the earrings of thought. The trick is in the balance. The balance in philosophy, by the terms of which Milton can relate the physical to the spiritual, the balance in poetry, by the control of the language of the senses through the ideas, the truth, that leads the world to fail and to well-ordered science. The balance, such as these lines, speak of and demonstrate. O Adam, one Almighty is, and from whom all things proceed, and up to him we come. This map decays from good, created aspects to perfection. One first matter of all, imbued with various things, various degrees of substance, and in things that move of life, but more refined, more spiritual, and pure, and nearer to him close, or nearer tender, each in their several active spheres of time, their body of the spirit works and bound proportion to each time. So, from the root, things lighter the green spark, condensed the leaves more old. Last the bright comes from a flower, spirit, odorous, fruit. Flowers near fruit, man's nourishment. By gradual spirit, the blind to vital spirit, which spells to animals, to intellectuals, gives both life and sense, answer, and understanding. Both the soul, reason, you see, and reason is obeyed, expression, and important. The order that controls the world is the order that Milton's idea of the scheme of nature presents in this. The words, and most of them, are predetermined by the scheme and the historical use and the development of that scheme. But for the sake of style and distinction and interest, Milton allows himself to add, are in the devices of amplification, and occasional inversion of symmetrical, in short and greater. The first and last thing is in the statement of the fact. And in the outline of the scheme that codifies its structurality. Milton's descriptions of the forces of nature differ in the intensity of their sensuousness. And in general, it appears that the intensity of sensual imagery varies directly as he emphasizes the teleology of nature. For instance, in the quite objective transposition from Genesis of the description of the creation of plants, the language that speaks of the earth as a mother is almost simply ornamental.
But the earth took forth the word of God, earth yielding food, and fruit tree, yielding food after her kind. She seated in herself upon the earth,